Hi everyone, welcome to our podcast series, What About Us? Culture Awareness in Clinical Psychology. I'm Afsana. So, in this episode, we're joined by Dr. Andrew Beck, who has over 30 years of experience of working within the clinical psychology profession. And in this episode, Andrew talks about the effective ways and strategies to work cross-culturally. And this includes ways to increase access to therapy and also how to make culturally sensitive adaptations. So let's have a listen to what Andrew had to say. So, hi there, Andrew. Thank you for joining me today. So if you can just start off with telling me a little bit about you, what you do and your role, please.
Okay, Afsana. I'm a clinical psychologist and I work in CAMHS, so in child mental health, and I have done for about 15, 16 years now, and I worked in adult mental health before that.
Okay. So can you just tell me a little bit about then your experience of working with diverse clients and groups?
That's a very good question. So I started training as a clinical psychologist in 1997.
Okay.
My first placement was in East London in Tower Hamlets, where I trained with a cognitive behaviour therapist called Peter Butcher. And so I'd never really done any therapy at that point, and I'd never kind of worked in a psychology service. I've come from a research background, really. I'm working in care homes. So right from the start, the therapy that I did was across cultures, because Tower Hamlets is the largest community in Tower Hamlets is Bangladeshi.
Right.
So right from the start, I was kind of having to figure out how to be a therapist, but also be a therapist across cultures. And I've worked in diverse areas ever since, really. So it's always been a kind of ongoing interest.
Right, okay, that sounds really interesting. So when you were working with the Bangladeshi community, what kind of sort of adaptations did you have to make to your therapy, for example?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I think the first adaptation was even before therapy.
Okay.
And that was about getting people to come to therapy.
Right.
Because this was a community that was not really well versed in talking about mental health in the way it's talked about in the West, but there were different community understandings of mental health. So what we found is, and what Peter Bush found, is that the uptake rate was lower than you would expect. So even before that point of sitting in a room, we had to figure out how to get people to come and sit in the room.
Right.
And that could often be as simple as just calling, really, before an appointment, before a first appointment, and checking people's expectations and hopes and being reassuring and helpful. But then, of course, that first phone call might throw up the fact that the person who'd been referred to you didn't speak English. That was kind of useful to find that out at first, because sometimes GPs wouldn't let us know that in the referral forms. So then we had to think, okay, we're going to do this first discussion. How are we going to do that without a common language to start with? So lots of adaptations before you've even got in the room, really. But then in the room, it could vary massively, because so late 90s in Tower Hamlets, we were starting in adult services to get kind of third-generation Bangladeshi service users, as well as first-generation Bangladeshi service users. So there was a whole difference in terms of understanding, language, and hopes for therapy that varied within that community as well. So a lot of the adaptation was figuring out where someone was in terms of their understanding of mental health and what their hopes were, and how we could think about what we did in the context of that.
Yeah. So if we think back to that then, so what do you think some of the challenges were in terms of them accessing services? So why do you think that occurred?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think part of it is that the referral was made without the reason for the referral being clearly explained.
Right.
So, and because if your understanding of why you're distressed is around perhaps physical causes, which it sometimes was, and then your GP has sent you to an appointment to see a psychologist, the difficulty there is, well, they're thinking, well, why am I going to go and see a psychologist? What I need is some tests or some medicine.
Right.
How is this going to meet my health needs? So that could often be something that got in the way. And that was particularly the case with our first generation service users. So that was something that we had to think about, really, and how we could develop models and ways of talking about distress that were compatible with their beliefs.
Right, okay.
And that was kind of easy in some ways, because it's a little bit how psychologists work in the physical health field. So if you're a psychologist working in a diabetes clinic, you'll be working with people who have an underlying physical condition, but what you're saying is, well, you know, my expertise is not to treat your underlying condition, it's to help you live well with the challenges that brings.
Yeah.
So you develop a kind of compatible model that takes into account people's own views about why they're distressed, with ideas about what you might find useful. So that was really interesting. It was a very steep learning curve, because in 97, really not a lot had been written on the adaptation of therapy. And about the only thing that had been written at all was a book called Transcultural Counselling in Action, which is written by Pat Darden and Aruna Matani, who were both based in East London, luckily.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both psychologists, both clinical psychologists, and had sort of written a very generic book to help you think about some of those issues. And I've got to say, that book must be 25 years old now, and it's still something I go back to. It's absolutely brilliant as a resource, and really helped those of us figuring our way through this to orientate ourselves to some of the issues.
Yeah. So, I know generally in practice, we offer conventional types of therapy, such as CBT, for example. So how did you find using those sort of Western models with diverse clients?
Yeah, well, that's interesting. How did I find it? I think for some service users, you could use it as it looked in the book, and it would be effective.
Okay.
And there was no need for any adaptation, really. And that was probably more true of second and third generation young adults who were coming through the adult service at the time. So that sort of model developed in the United Kingdom, you know, that we'd be using the kind of the classic sort of Clark panic model, or the Ellis and Clark PTSD model, which, you know, seemed fairly effective. But then I think with sort of first generation service users, or service users that had a particular worldview that might not have been completely compatible with that view of distress, then you had to look at where you find your middle ground, because what you'll find is that service users within their own cultural practice and understandings will have ways of managing difficult situations that fit with them and fit with their context. And in some ways, your job as a therapist is to figure out what they are with them and help them to sort of boost the ones that are useful. And then, as you would with any service user from any cultural background, also think about the strategies that they've been using that aren't useful, that are in fact kind of keeping the problem going, and helping people to figure out which ones of those to drop because they're not helping, and which ones to do more of because they are helpful. So it's a collaborative model, and I think actually that's true of really most therapies, isn't it? It's a collaborative enterprise between the therapist and the service user to find a shared understanding of the problem that then leads to some solution.
Yeah. No, that makes total sense.
And I do think I would really emphasise that collaborative nature of it, which is, sometimes forgotten in the way that CBT is talked about, but actually, if you look to the core texts and the way it's really thought about, it is a joint enterprise, and that includes a joint enterprise when you're working across cultures and different models of mental health.
Yeah. So why do you think cultural competence is important then within clinical practice?
Oh, it's a really good question. And so I'm going to give a typical psychologist's answer, right?
Okay.
Which might not be a massively helpful one. And it's what do we mean by cultural competence, first of all? So And there's a whole debate about what that should mean in mental health service, isn't there? And and whether even kind of cultural competence training actually changes the behaviour of therapists in the room enough to make a difference. So if I think about a definition that's kind of fairly uncontroversial, I would say cultural competence is just an acknowledgement of your own cultural position and the cultural position of the service user, and having the ability as a therapist to think about where you find that middle ground.
Right.
For me, that's largely cultural competence. And of course, I mean, I think what gets problematic is when ideas about cultural competence boil down to things like, well, all people from this community kind of think that way, or if you've got someone from this religious group, then they're probably going to think their mental health problem is caused by that. And of course, that, for me, is the opposite of cultural competence. That's a sort of set of fairly fixed and unhelpful beliefs about others that will actually get in the way of good therapy. Because what we know is the variation of beliefs and practices within communities is often as big as the differences between communities. There's a whole, in my community, I'm white, Northern English, from a sort of Northern working class background. Now, the amount of religiosity in my community varies from incredibly devout to sort of atheist, really. And although the majority of people are Christian in my community, you'll get different faiths as well, or some sort of sects of Christianity that are so kind of different from mainstream Christianity that there may as well be another religion altogether. So there's massive breadth of beliefs about things often in my community about ghosts as well. So some people in my community really strongly believe in ghosts and spirits, and enact rituals and do things that take that belief into account, and for others it's a complete would think it's nonsense. So I suppose a little bit of cultural competency is around acknowledging that breadth within individuals, really, that potential for breadth of positions, and not kind of jump into conclusions, not making assumptions. I think that's really important if we're working in diverse communities.
Yeah, so, I mean, what would you sort of say to then, you know, aspiring clinical psychologists who want to get into clinical practice and maybe might come across working with diverse groups?
Yeah, I think take a few minutes to think about where you're coming from yourself, to think about your own background and your own kind of spirituality, your own understanding of the world, and go into that world with some kind of modesty, really, that that whatever your position is, it's just one of many positions, and what you need to be is respectful and curious about other ones, and even if they may sound really quite odd to you, or superstitious, or old-fashioned, or whatever it is, that you know, be aware of those kind of values you might be making, really, and be able to sort of meet that difference with a kind of respectful equality, you know. Fully respecting your own and your service user's position, and then if you are interested in cross-cultural work, and particularly if you're from a white background where you've maybe not had to think about difference too much, you know, it's easy to grow up in England and not be around people of different cultures, really. And that's from whatever culture you're in. You know, my wife's from a Sikh background, and until she went to university, she didn't have any friends who weren't Punjabi Sikh. You know, so certainly, you know, a lot of people from white backgrounds will grow up in entirely white communities with very little contact outside their community. And so I suppose what you need to do, I mean, you can't just kind of go out to set out to spend time with people from other cultures. You know, that's kind of a bit of, this feels like cultural tourism, really, doesn't it? But become interested in the cultures around you a little bit, and just sort of curious about, you know, we know that there's over a million people from Poland living in the UK now. What do I know about that community? Now, this is a community that's going to come through. What's the history of that community? How did people from that community end up in the UK? What are the struggles that they have? What are the strengths that they bring? And just be kind of interested in the world around you a little bit as a way of sensitising yourself to do that in the clinic room. But then I also think the thing you need is a good supervisor, and a supervisor who's able to if you're going to be a clinician, you need a supervisor who can reflect on that a little bit and help you think about diversity. Mm. And I think it would be incredibly difficult to develop skills as a cross-cultural therapist without a supervisor who could help you do that thinking, really, because it's tough, you know, it's intellectually challenging. And, yeah. and when you learn in a therapy, it's hard anyway to learn a new right. therapeutic approach. And then if you're also learning it whilst learning how to adapt it, it's even more of a challenge.
Yeah. No, that definitely
makes sense.
No, that makes perfect sense. And I think that's really interesting, some of those points that you've raised there. And I think, you know, it will definitely help, you know, diverse groups yeah. who have issues around language barriers. I mean, how do you normally deal with that sort of situation?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Because some people who are first generation migrants to the UK yeah. will speak English as a second language,
yeah.
and some will speak it incredibly well.
Mm.
And so then it's not so much a language barrier as a conceptual barrier.
Right.
Of sort of someone may still speak really good English, but their worldview will still be very much kind of rooted in the worldview of the their kind of mother culture, yeah,
right.
the culture that they kind of grew up in. But for people who are non-English speaking, I think there's a real challenge there around how can you adapt the way you work. And we know from Pat Nadenne's work in particular,
mm-hmm.
he did really robust studies in East London looking at interpreter-mediated CBT in her trauma clinic that she set up, and found that outcome rates were just as good, provided you had a team that were well-trained in cross-cultural working,
yeah.
and a team that discussed that, and also worked with interpreters who were well-trained and well-supported.
Right.
So I suppose one of the things I would emphasise is your interpreter's not like Google Translate, and they're not just the sort of thing that you put words in and get words out.
Right.
Actually, your interpreter is the third person in the room, and ideally it should be someone that you're familiar working with,
mm-hmm.
that you're comfortable with, and you've developed a shared language and understanding with over time. And I think without that, you don't have much chance. And I was really lucky in East London, so we ran a clinic for many years with a Bangladeshi men's clinic.
Okay.
And we just had one interpreter for that clinic, so an older man from that community who became very skilled in the kind of conceptual side of the work that we did. He had a good understanding of how, very skilled in advising us on how to be better at our jobs.
Right, okay.
And giving us feedback about what we needed to improve. And actually brought masses to that clinic. And I don't think we could have done a good clinic without him, to be honest.
That's brilliant. I mean, that sounds really interesting. And I think that, you know, it is very important to have that kind of alliance with interpreters as well within practice.
Yeah.
So is there any other sort of challenges or anything else that you want to add to this?
Well, you know, if someone really does want to become a good cross-cultural therapist, I suppose there's tons of stuff written out there now that you can start to look at. And I'm sure you'll be directing people to some of the accessible and kind of clear writing on this topic.
Mm-hmm.
I think surrounding yourself with other people who are interested will help, because, you know, whatever it is you're interested in, to have a peer group who are also interested in it helps kind of motivate you and helps develop your skills and interests. I think whatever professional organisation you're part of, whether that's BABCP or DPS or the Association of Family Therapy, they will have special interest groups thinking about culture and diversity. So to join those, you know, it's a good way to find your network, really.
Mm-hmm.
And then do look for a good supervisor, I think, would be my last bit of advice, really.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. Thank you so much, Andrew, for your time. I really appreciate this. And I think
that's a pleasure, Sarah.
No worries. I think this will be very useful for our students. So thank you so much for, you know, coming in as a guest for us today.
Not at all. And if you want to do a follow up, for example, if your students come up with a ton of questions, I'm really happy to do this again.
Oh, brilliant! Thank you so much, Andrew. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode, and I'm sure you'll agree Andrew's wealth of experience and knowledge of working with diverse communities is really important, particularly for those who wish to work cross-culturally. So I hope that you found this episode useful, and we hope to join you again for the next one. Take care. Bye-bye.